Thank you, Sue. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is February 25th, 2021. I'm Louise Devery-Bjorkman, and I am joined this morning by Chief Judge Susan Siegel and Judge Edward Cleary. We are handling five cases on our calendar this morning, and the next matter up for oral argument is the case of James Hunter versus Kim Coughlin. We are proceeding by Zoom today, but our procedures otherwise remain the same. You will each have 15 minutes to present your argument, and counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. The timing will be indicated in the screen, which for me is up on the top left-hand side of the gallery view, but it may be in a different place on your screen. It's important that you state your name and identify the party that you represent when you begin your argument. And so with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. The key issue seems to be the distinction between written and oral defamation, essentially slander and libel. It's easy to repeat libel. It's easy to repeat it word for word, print out a copy of what is printed. Slander, oral statements, almost never possible to repeat word for word unless it's perhaps an extremely short statement, one or two words. The rule for a written defamation libel, Moreno stated Moreno v. Crookston Times Publishing Company, other cases, repeat word for word, and again, easy to do when dealing with a written statement. The Husum v. St. Bernilde Margaret School case, relied upon in respondent's brief, the complaint in that matter was extremely vague. The accusation of defamatory statements made were extremely vague, despite the case being in the summary judgment stage. That case was far more advanced than this one. It was in the summary judgment stage. Discovery had been pursued, completed, plenty of opportunity to make a thorough investigation. Despite all of that, the complaining party was extremely vague. And to quote from that case, the Husums did not, after reviewing the record thoroughly, it was not possible to say who said what, to whom it was said, how it was said or when it was allegedly said. Very broad generalizations. And the Smartwood case, another unpublished case referred to in appellant's memorandum, I believe also discussed by respondent, allegations were more specific than Husum. The claim was that the party who conducted defamation in late September told members of the women's tennis team to stay away from Mr. Smartwood as he was a sexual predator who acted inappropriately around young women. And, you know, and these were oral statements, they weren't in writing, and the Court of Appeals found that that was sufficient, that the rule of verbatim repetition set out in Moreno, American Book, and other cases involving written defamation did not apply to slander, oral defamation.
Mr. Shaw. Let me ask you this. I don't disagree with that, but in looking at your complaint, I'm looking in specifically at paragraph 5. You make an allegation of when statements were made early in the year 2016. You indicate that defendants Coughlin and Randolph made statements. You identify particular people to whom statements are made, but you, other than saying that false and defamatory statements were made, there's no indication of the content of the statement. How is that sufficient to state an actionable defamation claim under Minnesota law?
Thank you, Your Honor. And I would refer the court to other to other portions of the amended complaint. I would call the court's attention, if I may, to paragraph 12, where statements were made by defendants that certain witnesses would realize a financial reward if he was convicted. I'd refer to paragraph 18, where defendant Randolph made statements that someone should take appellant somewhere, kill him and bury him. And I would refer to paragraph 20, where statements were made by defendant Randolph to a local citizen, a Chris Ryan, that appellant was a criminal. I refer to paragraph 30, where a memorandum was distributed to officers of the Crosby Police Department saying they should have no contact with appellant. And I'd refer to paragraph 31, where Defendant Coughlin made statements to an individual, Thomas McCartan, that appellant had been charged with a crime involving sexual assault of a family member. And I'd refer to paragraph 39, where defendant Randolph made statements that, you know, witnesses who testified in favor of appellant at the Mr. Appellant's three criminal jury trials must have been paid off. You know, those statements, to select some, were specific. They said who made the statements, defendants Coughlin or Randolph. They said
so can I interrupt you here for a minute, Mr. Shaw? So some of those statements were made back in 2017. So, and one of the grounds on which the district court dismissed parts of the complaint was on the basis of statute of limitations. And there's a 2-year statute. So are you conceding that things that were said outside of that 2-year window are barred by the statute of limitations?
Thank you. Well, I would have two responses to that. I would note that many of the statements were made within the statute of limitations period, you know, within the 2-year period prior to the commencement of the action, Your Honor. So those would not be barred by a statute of limitations. As to the statements that were made outside of the 2-year period, I certainly would acknowledge that some were. Yeah, I do believe that equitable tolling is appropriate because the conduct of defendants of falsely accusing plaintiff of a crime, of an extensive prosecution that didn't end until the spring of 2019, it was simply impossible for appellant to take any action. Discovery was not available in a criminal proceeding.
Well, it's not impossible. I mean, it happens all the time, as a matter of fact. And the civil action, you know, there can be a request for a stay, so it's not impossible.
Well, I understood, Your Honor, but I would say it's extremely difficult if one does not know, is not able to find out exactly what was said. Most of this came to light after the criminal proceeding was over. So if one doesn't know what was said until after the criminal proceeding's over, then I would say it's at least extremely difficult.
Was that a new argument? Did you make that in front of the district court? And if so, where is that reflected?
It was made in front of the district court, Your Honor. It was contained in the memoranda and in the oral argument on the Rule 12 motion, Your Honor. That was contained in the memoranda submitted to the district court.
So you're arguing kind of a discovery that you didn't discover it until later. Your client didn't discover it until later. Is that right?
With respect to some of the accusations, the ones that are outside the statute of limitations, yes.
Correct me if I'm wrong, you don't allege fraudulent concealment anywhere in the, I guess it's the first amended complaint, do you?
It is not alleged in the complaint, that's correct. And thank you, Your Honor. And, you know, again, I would refer to the Smartwood case that where plaintiff appellant has provided a lot more detail than what was found sufficient and smart. In the paragraphs I referred to, the appellant said who made the statements, roughly when they were made, had a, if not verbatim, pretty close to the exact text of the statements. There are a lot more specifics than what was in Smartwood, and which the court in Smartwood found sufficient to defeat a Rule 12 motion, as opposed to a summary judgment motion in a case like Husum, which had far less specifics in any event. And it also, I think it's appropriate to look at the complaint as a whole. I mean, one could certainly look at individual paragraphs, and there are some of the allegations do go before the 2-year statute of limitations period, but many of the claim defamation is within the 2-year statute of limitations period.
Mr. Shaw, with respect to defamation, I mean, with all due respect, it has to be a specific statement of fact that's published. So a course of conduct, that sounds like a different tort to me. Why is that not a different tort that you're talking about there?
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. Well, I would say in the amended complaint, there are specific statements, not just the course of conduct. Obviously, I think a course of conduct sets the context, but there are specific statements, you know, in the amended complaint that appellant committed criminal acts, That appellant was charged with a crime involving the sexual assault of a family member. That appellant should be taken somewhere, killed and buried. Witnesses testified in favor.
Why is that not opinion? I mean, why is that not, you know, people make statements all the time. That doesn't mean that they're defamatory. I think this guy is a jerk. I mean, is that a statement of opinion or a statement of fact?
I would say saying that someone was charged with a crime sexually assaulting a family member, that's a specific statement. That's defamation per se, accusing someone of a crime. That is more than opinion. Same thing as saying that someone paid off witnesses. That's a crime. That's an accusation of a crime. That's more than opinion. And with respect to the statement that appellant should be taken somewhere, killed and buried, when that's made by a uniformed police officer acting under authority of the city, the city of Crosby, that is more than just a mere opinion of saying someone is a jerk. That's a government official, a police officer, a lieutenant, a high-ranking officer saying someone should be killed. That's more weight than just me, a private citizen, saying that so-and-so is a jerk. I would say—
Counsel, you're suggesting, I think, a different variety of opinion. In other words, the position of authority somehow negates the opinion aspects of that and makes it defamatory. Do you have case law that would suggest that that's the case?
Yeah, but I don't have specific case law on that issue. But I would refer to the cases cited in the memorandum of both parties that, you know, there's a line of where it goes from opinion to fact. And if we're talking about the statement about being killed and buried, I think that's quantitatively different than saying someone's a jerk or an unpleasant person. And I would say that the other statements that he's been charged with a crime, that he's bribed witnesses, those are not opinion. Those are factual statements.
When it comes to the opinion language or not opinion language, depending on how you view it, the status of the person saying it, that is, whether they're a bus driver or a police officer, there is no law that would suggest there's different standards in analyzing whether there's an opinion, is there?
I would agree with that, Your Honor, but I would say that saying someone should be killed and buried is different than saying that someone is an unpleasant person, is rude, is not nice, is wrong. I think we're getting into a different substantive area, Your Honor.
Well, again, that's the language that's used rather than the person who's saying it, that's all.
Well, and my question, Mr. Shaw, is, you know, isn't the statement that somebody should kill him or I wish somebody would kill him? I mean, it seems to me that would be relevant to the question about whether other statements are made with malice or ill will. But I don't understand how that's a expression of a of a statement of fact that's capable of being proven true or false.
Yeah, understood, Your Honor, and I would agree that it certainly does go to the issue of malice. I think it certainly helps to show actual malice of ill will of these defendants toward respondents towards appellant. I would certainly agree with that, Your Honor. And I would also agree with that we are looking at specific statements as opposed to just a course of conduct, but I think it's important to look at them in the context that these statements aren't isolated, that they are made by defendants under official authority. Certainly the statements that defendant Randolph thinks that appellant should be killed and buried does go to the issue of malice, does show actual malice, ill will towards appellant. I think it is certainly relevant on that. And that comparing the complaint in this matter with the complaint in Smartwood, there are a lot more specifics than what was in Smartwood. Smartwood was found to be sufficient to get past the Rule 12 stage. It was found to have enough specifics. There are certainly more specifics here as far as what was said, when it was said, who said it, and most of these statements are within the two-year period, so one doesn't have to get into an equitable 12-year concealment argument. They're within the two-year statute of limitations period. And they do fall into a pattern of respondents seeking to eliminate appellant as a potential opponent with false accusations, with repeated defamatory statements, and certainly with actual malice based on the statements that they believe that he should be dead. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, when we get the clock reset, you may proceed, which I guess is now. Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, Patrick Collins and Joseph Flynn on behalf of the defendants. There's a lot to get to, but I'd first like to point out that for over 100 years, Minnesota courts have applied strict pleading requirements in defamation cases. Consistent with that law, the district court analyzed each and every one of Mr. Hunter's allegations and pointed out multiple reasons why they should be dismissed with prejudice. We did the same in our brief. However, on the other hand, Mr. Hunter has repeatedly refused to analyze each and every one of his claims. And in fact, he goes so far as to say the district court erred by doing so. In other words, Mr. Hunter is putting the burden upon this court to sift through his 57-page complaint to make heads or tails of his claims. Because of litigants like Mr. Hunter, the specificity and strict pleading requirements for defamation is vital to forming a responsive pleading and determining applicable defenses. Now, in this case, Your Honors, the district court dismissed paragraphs 5 through 25, 31 through 32, 34 through 38, and 42 through 44 based on a lack of specificity. Now, with regard to the written allegations of defamation, it is, as you heard Mr. Shaw say that, and in his brief, he admits that in those situations, verbatim language needs to be cited. If you look at his complaint, which is the only thing that the court looks at, he has failed to do so. He has failed to state verbatim what he claims is defamatory in the written documents that are attached to his brief, which are contained in paragraphs 8 through 12, 23, and 31 through 32. Therefore, it is undisputed that the district court was correct in dismissing those claims with prejudice. That leaves the oral defamatory statements, which are contained in paragraphs 5 through 7, 13 through 15, 19 through 22, 24, 35, and 37, and 39 through 41. Now, Mr. Hunter's only opposition to the dismissal of those claims, as he stated in his oral argument, is that oral defamatory statements do not need to be pled verbatim. Now, we obviously disagree, and we cited many cases in support of our argument. The cases we cited are among SA versus the Hallmark Cards case, Pinto versus International, Moreno versus Crookston Times, and Pope versus ESA.
Oh, can I interrupt for a minute?
Sure.
So why can't we just assume that some of these statements are verbatim, like Mr. Shaw talked about the allegation that one of your clients said that Mr. Hunter was charged with sexually assaulting a family member. Why can't we just assume that that is the verbatim statement? I mean, as he points out, Swartwood, I mean, is kind of similar there in terms of that being the statement. At a Rule 12 stage, what would be wrong with that?
It would be wrong is that you put verbatim statements in quotes. There's only three paragraphs in Mr. Hunter's second shot at a complaint in quotes.
There's also case law saying that the statement itself, you know, you can kind of read into it a bit, even if the statement itself, isn't quite clear about damaging somebody's, you know, being the kind of statement that would damage somebody's reputation. So is it the absence of quote marks that, like, for example, on this sexual assault allegation, sexually assaulting a family member, that's the problem?
Well, that's one of the problems with that paragraph, Your Honor. The other problems are that he doesn't tell us when it was said.
In a couple of months, this is one of the allegations where it is a little, he said it's August or September of 2019.
Right.
And to whom?
Yes.
And we are at the Rule 12 stage. So how do you respond to that? Yeah.
That's right, Your Honor. He does not tell us where it was said. He also claims it's defamation per se. We look at his precise claims in that paragraph. He says this is defamation per se, which is one of the only two paragraphs where he states that. However, he fails to tell us how it affected his business or his.
It doesn't have to affect his business. It just has to be the kind of thing that's so odious that we presume damages. And I mean, it's not, defamation per se is not just limited to damaging your business, trade, or profession, isn't it?
I would,
like an or there in the definition of defamation per se.
No, I believe it has to involve the person's business or a calling. And we cite that in our briefs. Also, he is a public figure and he needs to allege actual malice, which he had.
But he does, at least in that paragraph. He said it was, the statement was made knowing it was false. So, I have to tell you, of all the paragraphs, that's the one paragraph that stuck out as me, is like, geez, we are at the Rule 12 stage.
Right. Right. Yeah. And the way I would respond to that paragraph, Your Honor, is that if you take, we cited the Steele versus Tell case, which is very similar to this situation. And in that situation, it was very similar to Mr. Hunter. Mr. Steele was a candidate for a state position. Somebody made the remark that he was under investigation for first degree sexual assault. He claimed that was defamation. This court dismissed it, saying, among other things, that, well, number one, he was a public figure, there was no evidence of actual malice. There was no evidence of damages, which is another ground in which the district court in this case dismissed all of the claims, which Mr. Hunter has failed to address. And in that case, they specifically said that it was because you have to, defamation per se, you have to say that they didn't say he committed the crime. They just said he was under investigation of the crime. And in this case, we just say they allege he had been charged with a crime, and the statement does not concern his business or personal or professional conduct, which in paragraph 30.
But Mr. Collins, let's just take out the line, this is defamation per se. Paragraph 33, as I understand it, all goes on to allege actual and obvious harm to his reputation. And elsewhere in the complaint, there are the allegations about the respondents indicating several times that they wished Mr. Hunter were dead or would die. And isn't that enough for Rule 12 purposes to establish actual malice and to meet the specificity requirements for pleading?
I would disagree, Your Honor. I don't believe it is. As you pointed out a number of times, is that those statements are opinions, which by definition are not defamatory. They're protected by—
Right, but why can't an opinion statement be reflective of actual malice? I agree with you that it's not a statement that can be proven true or false, but isn't it, for at least for Rule 12 purposes, aren't the allegations that such statements have been made sufficient to reflect actual malice?
I would disagree, Your Honor. I don't believe it is enough to allege actual malice. In fact, in his briefs, Mr. Hunter claims that he doesn't need to allege actual malice. He doesn't believe he's a public figure. And therefore, he doesn't need to allege actual malice. And in fact, the first time on appeal, he argues that actual malice is actually ill will, which I believe he is confusing the actual malice standard for overcoming qualified privilege versus the much higher actual malice standard for public figures that they must show by clear and convincing evidence.
So you're suggesting that the nature of how he argued would defeat what I look at as the language of the amended complaint, saying that he made repeated statements wishing he would die, which reflect actual malice behind the false and defamatory statements, that we should not so much focus on the language of the complaint, but the arguments as presented to the district court.
No, I believe you should consider both, but obviously on the scope of review is you take a look at the actual language of the complaint itself. So I agree with you, Your Honor. You look at the actual language of the second amended complaint itself. And if you take a look at the actual language of the brief itself, the complaint and the claims, the complaint itself, they fail to allege the claims with the specificity and the strict pleading requirements as required by the over 100 years of Minnesota law, and therefore the district court was correct in dismissing those claims on that basis. You've already touched on the statute of limitations issue. You're absolutely right that Mr. Hunter has failed to allege any grounds for tolling the statute of limitations, whether it be fraudulent concealment, and then for the first time on appeal, he claims that the statute of limitations should be tolled because the defendant's, quote, bad faith criminal prosecution of the appellant. Well, there's three major problems with that, Your Honors, is that number one, he's barred from making the claim because he's made it on the first time on appeal. The defendants did not prosecute Mr. Hunter, Crow Wing County did, and he has failed to cite any authority to support that claim whatsoever. I've already touched on the actual malice part of why his complaint, why the district court correctly denied the complaint. There is no dispute that Mr. Hunter is a public figure. He was a candidate for mayor of the city of Crosby, and it's public records in the Secretary of State's office. He was a mayor or candidate for mayor in 2012, 2014, 2016, 2018, and 2020. He was also elected mayor in 2016 and he resigned in 2017. And he was elected mayor in 2020 and is the current mayor of the city of Crosby. So there's no doubt that he is a public figure. And the only two paragraphs in which Mr. Hunter alleges actual malice is in paragraphs 11 and 15, which we touched on that paragraph 11 is an ethics complaint against Mr. Shaw, has nothing to do with Mr. Hunter, and therefore, by definition, it is not a defamatory statement. And paragraph 15 is the one where he claims that my client said that that they wished Hunter would die, which again is an opinion and is protected by the First Amendment and therefore is not defamatory. And so therefore the district court correctly dismissed those claims. Lastly, but certainly not least, the district court also denied dismissed all of Mr. Hunter's claims based on a failure to allege facts as to causation and damages. Mr. Hunter has failed to address those reasons in his initial brief to the court, and therefore, based on the black letter law, he has waived those claims. And for those reasons alone, the district court's decision should be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Shaw, you will have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honors. And concerning the issue of the level of specificity, I would read from the Smartwood decision, page 6. The Court of Appeals found that, Smartwood said that in a rough time, late September 2015, defendant told the members of the Bemidji State women's tennis team that Smartwood was a sexual predator and it acted inappropriately around young women. There was no verbatim quote of the statement. Nothing was in quotation marks. It was not repeated exactly because it's generally impossible to repeat word for word an oral statement, especially if you did not happen to be present when it was made. This was found in Smartwood to be specific enough, roughly when it was said, who said it, and the substance of the statement. We didn't have the statement word for word. Plaintiff's complaint contains appellant's numerous statements that are more specific than what was provided in Spartan and Smartwood, a higher level of specificity. There certainly is enough detail here, so respondents are clearly on notice as to what they're being accused of and can formulate a defense. And concerning the public figure argument, appellant certainly had run for office at times and briefly for a few months sat as mayor. At the time of the statements in question, I'll refer to paragraph 39 of the amended complaint. We're talking about June 2018, August 2018, March 2019. Appellant was not holding any office in 2018. He briefly ran for mayor of the city of Crosby, a city of 2,000 people. March 2019, he wasn't running for any office anywhere. Same thing in June 2018. So having at one point run for office for a city of 2,000 people does not make one a public figure. This isn't a former president or senator or mayor of a big city like Minneapolis. This is a very...
Where do we draw that line then? And then does somebody have to actually be in elective office? I've never seen that as a requirement. To be a public figure.
Certainly agree that you could be a public figure without being in public office. That's completely correct, Your Honor, but there has to be a line somewhere. Everybody who's run for mayor or council of every little city or town, that's a huge number of people.
But his whole complaint here is infused with there was this conspiracy against him because he was running for public office and he was in public office. I mean, go ahead. That wasn't really a question, I guess.
But no, that's a very good point. And that was certainly the motive here, to neutralize a political opponent. That's completely correct. And, at time he was briefly in office and he certainly was a public figure at that time. But the vast majority of these statements were made long after he was out of office and he was defending felony charges against him. He wasn't going to be in office at that point or be a serious candidate. He was defending several felony charges. And even if he was a public figure for when some of these defamatory statements were made, I think we've certainly more than proved actual malice. A defendant Randolph said he wanted appellant dead. It doesn't get much more malicious than wanting someone dead. I can't think of anything worse than that. So I think actual malice is clearly shown even for the times that appellant was a public figure. And I should note in response to counsel's argument, page 5 of the memorandum of law submitted to the district court in opposition to respondents motion to dismiss does make the equitable tolling arguments. That argument was certainly made at the motion to dismiss stage in the district court. It's certainly not being pulled out here for the first time. I think it certainly is a solid argument that does apply and it has been made before. And as far as counsel's waiver argument, I did deal with that briefly in the reply brief. I don't think it warrants much mention. It was based on a footnote to a case. You don't have to repeat every argument all the time or you waive something or we'd have, the arguments would never stop. Certainly appellant has provided enough specificity that said who, what, when, and where, and roughly when. More than enough to survive a Rule 12 motion. I'd certainly compare with Smartwood, a lot more specificity than in that case. Thank you, Your Honors. Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Counsel. We appreciate your arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. We will now recess pending the beginning of our next hearing at 11:10. Thank you, Counsel.